This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we'll be delving into the dark recesses of the psychological thriller. Sam Hepburn explains how her dark imaginings were inspired by real events. We revisit Graham McRae Burnett's disturbing first novel. Best-selling author Kate Hamer leads us into the unsettling, shadowy world of her new novel, The Doll Funeral. And I liberate a hidden gem from the library vaults while Robert interrogates its author as to why she writes under two separate identities. That's all coming up in today's show. Sam Hepburn is well known as an author of young adult fiction. Now she's turned her talents to adult fiction. Her Perfect Life is a deftly woven and deliciously chilling psychological thriller. Sam Hepburn, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you very much.
So, it's just out and receiving rave reviews. For those who haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, could you tell us something about the plot?
Yeah, it's basically about two women, roughly the same age. One of them's had a lot of luck in her life. She was running a sort of cake baking stall in a London market. Somebody wrote about her, and suddenly overnight she became a bit of a success. She's got her own TV show. She's a bit of a celeb. You know, she's doing really well. She's married to a very attractive architect. She's got a sweet little girl. It appears that her life really is perfect. Into this life comes Juliet. The cook is called Gracie. And Juliet, her life's gone the other way. It should have been good. She's ended up as a single mum, scraping a kind of freelance living together. And everything is a bit rubbish. And she's eaten up with jealousy that actually there was a point when her life came together with Gracie's. And she's eaten up with fury and bitterness that Gracie dropped her.
Her Perfect Life by Sam Hepburn. Read by Stephanie Racine. There she is. Our perfect, pocket-sized Gracie Dwyer. Clean, clean, clean in her perfect kitchen. She's leaning ever so slightly towards the camera, a come on, we can do this together smile on her lips, while her nimble little fingers beat flour into a pan of yellow gloop on a spotless stone worktop. The trick to perfect choux pastry, she is saying, is to keep beating until every fleck of white has gone from the mixture. Juliet tries for the off button, but her clumsy fingers hit the pause. Gracie freezes on screen. She stares at the face. Always, if you look long enough at a frozen frame, you can find something, some imperfection. A spot, a patch of caked makeup at the hairline, a drag in the skin at the throat. If not that, then something gormless and off guard in the eyes or in the halted movement of the mouth. Something. But there's nothing. Nothing at all. Gracie Dwyer is perpetually perfect. Even frozen.
It sounds brilliant. I can't wait to get my hands on it. So where did you get the idea from?
Well, interestingly, when you write for children and young adults, you get about a bit. So you go into schools, and I was invited to a children's writing festival in Sharjah. It was quite interesting because they had lots of writers and they also had lots of cooks. And there was a really lovely woman there who is a cook called Lily Vanilli. And it was her story. She was the person who had been writing, who had been baking, and she had a stall in Borough Market. And somebody from one of the Sundays came along and was looking for a piece to write, you know, lifestyle. What can I write? Oh, here's a baker. I'll write about baking. And so overnight, Lily's life completely changed. And that's what interested me, that moment in our lives when things can go one way or the other. And with Lily's permission, I used that story. So that was key. People tend to think about it in terms of relationships. If I hadn't been in, you know, in that place at that time, I wouldn't have met that person. But I think there are lots more points along the way where things can go both ways.
And I know that you worked for two decades as a BBC documentary filmmaker.
I did.
Do you then take the view that truth is stranger than fiction, that
all
totally.
The...
Yes, totally. And the thing is, obviously when I started, which was a long time ago, it was pre-Google, pre-internet, pre-computer probably. Yes, it definitely was. And so, you know, I'd come in, I'd be told to go and make a film about something. I had to get on a train. I had to go out and see people. I had to... So, you know, you met the most extraordinary people on the way, whereas now we're so tied to the desk. We're looking for our specific thing on Google and we miss out on, you know, all sorts of sites and places. So my very first kids' book, there was an awful lot of stuff that was just about some of the extraordinary people I'd met and the homes I'd been in and the lives I'd been privileged to have a look at, you know. So, yes.
Storytelling is an oral tradition. It's people swapping stories with each other. And I think that's something we tend to forget in our sort of screen-based world where...
Absolutely.
Where things have been doctored before they even get to you.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree about that.
Do you think that with all the attention that we pay to the internet, do you think there are subjects that you wouldn't touch as a storyteller even though they're on our screens?
I don't think so. I think it's how you do it. Particularly, I mean, this is a big debate when you're writing for children and young adults. Is there anything that you can't deal with? And I think the answer is no, but there are certainly ways that you shouldn't deal with specific subjects. You know, you have to have empathy, you have to have understanding, you have to do it in a way. I think it's a story is good. It can carry you through so many things. And let's face it, stories are often about dealing with the worst thing that we can imagine. And holding our hands as we walk through it and allowing us to see how we can come out the other side. I mean, you know, stories are about survival in many ways. So you have to go to the bad place very often.
Was there a reason that you moved from young adult fiction to adult fiction?
This book, the two characters, Gracie and Juliet, they're mothers. And as a mother... I kind of know that children aren't particularly interested in mothers. So, you know, I think if you're writing for young adults, you have to have a young adult protagonist. You know, you can have them in a world of adults, but, you know, I've got two women in their early 30s, and then I've got two little kids that are 5 and 6, and, you know, it wasn't a story. I suppose in a way you could have told it if it had an older child, but then the dynamic of the story would have been different. So it was a story about adults.
Do you feel that you will happily coexist with being a young adult writer and an adult writer in the future, or does one attract you more than the other?
Well, I'm actually trying to write both at the moment. I do know writers who get up very early and they do their adult in the morning and then, you know, I find it very difficult. So I tend to spend a few days on one and then a few days on the other. You could take almost any of the plots that I've done and you could do them for adults, but it would be, it's the approach, it's the way that you do it that would be very different.
And do you find editing your own work a pleasure or a hardship?
You've got to give yourself up to it, because looking at something from the outside, somebody else hasn't got your obsessions. They know when you've gone on too much about one thing or when something doesn't hold together, when you've made assumptions. And I think in the hands of a good editor, anything can be better. Obviously, if it's not a good editor, it could be terrible. And you can't just go along with everything they say. But I've got a brilliant agent who's really good at looking at things and saying, well, what about this? I'm not sure about that. So working with editors is, I think, absolutely key.
It's the oil that makes the prose flow in many ways, I think.
Absolutely. And also with plot, particularly when you're writing thrillers, something about pacing, you might get there too fast or it might be too slow or, you know, somebody else can come in and look at that pacing and say, no, you need to ramp it up a bit here or whatever.
There have been quite a few books published recently about the difference between what people see and what the reality is in a situation. And do you think that's symptomatic of the sort of post-truth malaise that we have in the West?
No, I think it's something deep within stories. In Nairobi, you can't walk around very much, so I go to the gym. And I've been listening to a lot of my favourite fiction, which is Victorian sensationalist fiction. It's very similar to what we're seeing now. Central female heroines who aren't what they seem. Obviously in a Victorian context where they, you know, they're sort of married to whatever and they have a dark secret. I think dark secrets, I think humans do put on a mask all the time, whatever society they're in, whatever age they're in. and stories behind people's masks are fascinating. And I think writers have written about that always. So it takes on a different form with every, you know, with every generation. But I think it's something intrinsic to, we love a mystery, you know? We love a mystery. I don't think there's anybody I know that I could say, I know that person, I know everything about them. They're constant surprises. But I think in the current context, yes, what is true and what is false is suddenly under the microscope.
Well, Sam Hepburn, thank you very much for coming in and joining us on Read On Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sam Hepburn's new novel, Her Perfect Life, is available as Talking Book 700070. And we'll be hearing more from Sam later in the show.
This is Read On Air.
Graham McRae Burnett's second novel, His Bloody Project, has attracted widespread praise and is shortlisted for this year's Man Booker Prize. Not quite so well known, but also well worth the read, is his debut, The Disappearance of Adele Bedeau. It's a story that takes you deep into the minds of both the investigating detective and the prime suspect. When the author came to hear it being recorded as a talking book, RNIB's Yvonne Milne caught up with him and narrator James Bryce.
The Talking Books team at RNIB are constantly recording new books to enable blind and partially sighted people access to as many books as possible. One book that's currently receiving the Talking Books treatment is The Disappearance of Adele Bedeau by Graham McRae Burnett and published by Saraband. I'm delighted that I'm joined now by its author, as well as James Bryce, who is the narrator of this talking book. Starting with you first, Graham, tell us a little bit about the book.
The Disappearance of Adele Bedeau is a literary crime novel set in a small town in France called Saint-Louis. Saint-Louis is quite a sort of dull and ordinary place on the Swiss border. The main characters are a bank manager called Manfred Baumann, and Manfred's a kind of outsider in the town. He's very awkward around people and ill at ease, and he lives a life of tremendous routine. He goes to the same restaurant every day for lunch and then later on to drink a bottle of wine at the bar counter. And Adele Bedeau, of the title, is a waitress in this restaurant who mysteriously disappears quite early in the book. And the investigation into her disappearance leads Manfred to kind of confront some of the things that have happened in his past, and we kind of begin to learn a little bit about why he's become such an awkward character.
As he turned the corner into Rue de Meuse, he spotted Adele 100 metres or so ahead. She was walking slowly, and Manfred found himself catching up with her. He could hear the clacking of her heels on the pavement. Manfred slowed his pace. He could hardly stride past her without making some kind of greeting, and this would lead to them falling into inevitably awkward conversation. Perhaps Adele would think he had followed her. Or perhaps her flirtatious display in the restaurant had actually been for his benefit, and she had deliberately walked in this direction to contrive a meeting. No matter how much he slowed his pace, Manfred continued to gain ground. The closer he got, the slower Adele seemed to become. At one point, she stopped, and, steadying herself on a lamppost, adjusted the ankle strap of her shoe. Manfred was now barely 20 metres behind her. He bent down and pretended to tie his shoelace. He hunched his head over his knee, hoping that Adele would not spot him. He listened to the clack of her heels on the pavement grow fainter. When he looked up, she was no longer in sight.
It's quite a psychological book, isn't it?
A lot of the action takes place inside Manfred's head. It's really, although it's not written in the first person, but we kind of perceive the world through his eyes. He's quite kind of paranoid about the way people react to him, and very small incidents become quite exaggerated in his mind. It's all about his kind of thought processes and how he reacts to things.
And I imagine, because I mean, it's kind of crime at its heart, but it's kind of literary crime. Is it very difficult when you're writing a book like this not to trip yourself up a little bit with the plot?
I think there I didn't plan anything. I'd actually been to this town in France with a friend, and we went for lunch in a certain restaurant. And, you know, so through kind of observing the characters there, that's how I came up for the idea for the story. But I started from that very basic scenario and then just kept writing. So I didn't know what was going to happen. So some of the things that happen in the novel that have been surprising for readers were kind of equally surprising to me as I went along. And when you do work that way, you can kind of paint yourself into a corner. You can create a situation and you don't know how to resolve it. Although there are some surprising events, it's not a novel of great plot twists. It's more of a, I would say it's more of a slow burn, you know.
This is your first novel?
Yes.
Yes. So what, I get the idea from you, I mean, you have a degree in English, mm-hmm. That you've always written, or is this what made you decide to do your first novel?
Well, like most people whose first novel comes out, it's not their first novel. I'd written another novel before, which wasn't published, which was a kind of a more straight crime novel. But I'd also started at least three other novels, and it's interesting when you kind of serve your apprenticeship like that.
Yeah. And the disappearance of Adèle Bodo has received huge critical acclaim. Did you know when you'd written this one, this is it, I've cracked it?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I thought it's quite strange, as I say. It's set in a very obscure town in France, which is described as being drab and nondescript. A lot of people really relate to the characters, but they're not. And it's very important that you root for the character, especially for Manfred, even although he's kind of weird and a lot of people say he's a bit creepy. But I thought it was quite an obscure thing for a Scottish writer to do. And I think when you're approaching publishers, it's a crime novel. It's got elements of a crime novel and it's kind of got elements of literary fiction, but it's almost neither. So it's difficult to categorise it. And I certainly didn't think I'd cracked it. So when Saraband came along and said they would publish it, I was, you know, obviously very, very happy, and I've had a great experience with them.
Oh, that's great. And do you find when you actually then have to kind of reveal it to the public, is that quite nerve-wracking because it's been your kind of baby, you've been writing in the dark, so to speak, all this time?
Yeah. I mean, I thought I was completely normal until my book came out and then found that people reacted in a different way to the character. So, yeah, of course, it's nerve-wracking, but, I mean, it's what you want. So, and thankfully, people have generally been very kind about the book. I think when it's a first novel, people tend to be reasonably kind. If they don't like it, they're probably not going to print a review in a newspaper of a first novel just to be critical of it.
I don't know. I don't know. I think you're being very modest there.
Well, I mean, I've been delighted with the reaction it's had, and both from readers and from reviewers.
Manfred felt that the detective was scrutinising him. If there was a flicker of recognition in his grey eyes, he would most likely ascribe it to the fact that in a town like Saint-Louis, the inhabitants crossed paths a great deal. Indeed, though he generally kept to the opposite pavement, Manfred walked past the police station on his way to and from the Restaurant de la Cloche every day. It would, in fact, be odd if the detective had never seen him. Manfred felt like he was in a scene from a film. Next, the cop would say, "You haven't asked me what this is about." And he would immediately fall under suspicion. But Manfred had missed his opportunity. Whatever he said now would sound stilted and unnatural. Of course, he suspected why Gorski was there. In a sense, he had been expecting him. He should have confined himself to a polite, "How can I help you?" Or he should have said straight out that he assumed the policeman's visit was something to do with the waitress.
This is the next step for you now that it's been turned into a talking
Absolutely. Book
for RNIB. How important is it for you that your work is accessible to someone who's blind or partially sighted?
It's a really interesting thing to think about, because one of the things when I'm writing is that I really want the reader to have a rich sort of visual picture of the milieu of the novel. But I don't know how this works for visually impaired people, but I do make quite a lot of effort to create a visual picture of the locations of the novel. So, yeah, I mean, are we really interested if I get any feedback from visually impaired people about how they experience the world of the novel? So that's going to be a really interesting thing.
Well, a big part of creating that whole image comes down to our narrator, James Bryce, who's with us as well. And you've been narrating The Disappearance of Adele Badeau. How has that been for you?
It's been great. For the novel itself, it was one of these novels where I really had to force myself not to finish it at one sitting. And that's good. That's good, because I was really taken by it. I found the character of Manfred fascinating. And indeed, one of the things that I felt about him was that I recognised him, that certain traits he had were traits I have amplified, and I believe the traits of quite a few people.
Yeah, he's a bit of a loner, and say he comes over sometimes a little bit weird, a little bit kind of creepy, Graham was saying there. But as you say, I think we all have that in us, don't we?
We all have that. I mean, there is a thing to be said. I mean, as working as an actor, I tend to see the characters from the inside anyway. And I remember years ago playing this vicious villain in a 16th century play, and said, "Oh," people said, "Oh, he's really horrible." And I actually couldn't see it by the end because I was inside it. If I looked outside, I'd say, "Oh, yeah, he's horrible." But I think one of the things that Graham's book does wonderfully is get so into the character that you can understand why he is.
You get
what
the
motive.
Yes, you get the motivations behind why he is the way he is.
Sure.
And for you, when you come to a book, it's not just like reading a book. I would imagine when you know you're going to actually have to sort of read this out loud and bring it to life with characters and voices. Mm-hmm. What's your process for doing that, James?
My initial process is I read the book. If there's anything about the character, either said by someone else or described the book, I'll put a little C by it. If there's anything about pronunciation, I put a little P by it. I've got little dots and periods all over the place about sort of where to take a breath or where to remind myself that there's something coming. If I feel there's a bit that needs to slow down a little bit, I have various musical markings. It's just actually the way I do it. And then once I've finished the whole thing, I have a whole list of pronunciations to look up, and I then go through the book, extracting all the descriptions of the character.
So this has been an enjoyable experience.
Very.
Do you ever get a bit where you think, oh, I can't be bothered with that? Or do you only ever take on projects that you think, I really can bring something to this?
I take what I'm given.
You're very honest.
But we were very happy when we heard James's voice, and it seemed really perfect for the book.
Yeah.
It's got a really nice quality and a sort of air of intrigue, and then something in the intonation that you're even, I can imagine it can make quite ordinary things seem a little bit mysterious, and that's perfect for the tone of the book.
Finally, Graham, maybe you can give some advice to some of our listeners who might be thinking, I would like to be able to write, or I've been thinking about writing my first novel.
Well, I mean, the advice is really very obvious, and I think anybody who is thinking about writing would know that what you have to do is sit down and write something. I mean, I struggled tremendously to write this book, and it's very, very difficult when you're starting out and you don't imagine that anybody's going to take an interest in anything you've written. And it's always, always better to write something and throw it away than to not write anything. If I come out and I've written 1,000 words or 500 words or 50 words, I'd rather do that. There's no shortcuts in terms of writing. I try not to be too critical of what I've written. But, you know, have a bit of confidence in it. You know, it's like it is possible. You know, people who write are just normal people, like the listeners you might be talking about. So, you know, just
perseverance.
Yeah,
perseverance.
Give it a go, and you know, don't feel that you're not worthy.
I guess, and don't take a knockback. I mean, if you get knocked back, just
right.
Keep going.
You know, I had numerous publishers turned down this novel. You've got to be quite thick-skinned.
Thanks to you both, to James Bryce, our Talking Books narrator, and of course, Graham McRae-Burnett, author of The Disappearance of Adele Badeau.
Thanks to Yvonne, Graham and James. And The Disappearance of Adele Badeau is available as TB21716. His bloody project, of which more later, is TB23483.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Since both Switzerland's national products, snow and chocolate, melt, the cuckoo clock was invented solely in order to give tourists something solid to remember it by.
Chocolate and cuckoo clocks, the essential, Alan Corrin.
I imagine that's the dining room, I said.
That's what you want to do, Squire, they said. Imagine.
Edited and introduced by his children, Giles and Victoria Corrin, Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks is an anthology of writing from the former editor of Punch Alan Corrin.
Now is the time of year to stop writing gardening advice articles and move into a tower block.
Read by Peter Noble and featuring contributions by Victoria Wood, Melvin Bragg, Giles Corrin and Victoria Corrin-Mitchell.
So who's going to write the introduction?
I thought we were doing it together.
I don't know. I've never written with anyone else. He never wrote with anyone else.
It's not that hard. One person types, the other one paces.
Every day at 2 with a repeat at 10. Or you can catch up with the whole book online at the RNIB Connect radio website.
This is Read On Air.
In 2015, Kate Hamer's debut novel, The Girl in the Red Coat, became an instant bestseller. It's the haunting tale of every parent's worst nightmare. A young girl is abducted from a storytelling festival. As months, then years pass and she remains missing, the girl and her mother struggle to make sense of their shattered lives. And now Kate Hamer has returned with The Doll Funeral, and she joined me down the line from Cardiff to tell me about it. Kate Hamer, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you very much.
Your books focus on love, loss, friendship and family, and you write about some really heartbreaking events in people's lives with great beauty and lyricism and an almost dreamlike quality. What attracts you to the dark side of the human psyche?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, on my Twitter profile, I'm mostly really happy, but I write dark. And I just think it's those psychological spaces that we've all experienced that draw me, and the kind of tension that you find there. So I would say that the new book as well, it's light and dark, hopefully. There's shades of both, hopefully, there.
Could you tell us a little bit about the plot of The Doll Funeral?
It centres around a girl called Ruby, and it starts on her 13th birthday.
20th of August, 1983. My 13th birthday, and I became a hunter for souls. I knew the moment that Mum called me something was going to happen. I heard it in her voice. Ruby? The open eye of the hall mirror watched as I came downstairs, humming a nervous tune. My yolk-yellow birthday blouse done right up to the neck, and my brown cord skirt flicking against a knee scab. The light from the open kitchen doorway, where my parents waited, puddled onto the dirty carpet in the hall. On the formica table was the birthday cake. It had white icing and Smarties. A big triangle wedge had been cut out, and the sharp carving knife lay close by, pointing into the gap. I blinked. I'd expected punishment for some minor crime committed, a cup broken or left unwashed, the back door left open or closed, or whichever way my father currently ordained its status. But instead, my mum and dad had turned into dolls, or puppets, or so it seemed. Hard lines had appeared, running from their noses to their chins. Mum's cheeks were blotched with anxious red paint, corkscrew curls exploding from her head. Dad was strung stiffly behind her in his grey felt jacket. His arm came up and swiped at his nose. Mum jiggled, her shoes clacking menacingly on the lino. Her jaw opened. Ruby, now we don't want you to create a scene or start trouble, but it's time you knew.
On her 13th birthday, her parents call her downstairs and basically tell her for the first time that she's not their child, she's actually an adopted child. And her response to this is that she absolutely runs out into the garden and just sings for joy, because it's like the best news that she's ever had. But there are reasons for that. Her upbringing up until that point has been a very difficult one. From then on, her quest really is to find her real parents. But obviously, a kind of mission like that can never really be straightforward. And she starts uncovering all sorts of secrets from the past that have remained buried for a long time. So it's kind of a dangerous mission that she's on.
There's a beautiful dreamlike quality to the world around her. There's a character called Shadow who sits on the stairs. There's the wasp lady who she sees.
Because she's lived this sort of very uncertain and difficult life, She has an awareness of things around her that not necessarily everybody else sees or understands. She's kind of hypervigilant and sensitive to the world in a way that everybody doesn't experience. She has a slightly tricksy character called Shadow, who's a little bit like the demon that sits on Lyra's shoulder in the Philip Pullman books, who's sometimes her friend and sometimes misleads her. We're never quite sure which, but she ends up having to take his advice because she doesn't have any choice.
Do you think with Ruby, she's unsure of her narrative, so she has to recreate it as a fairy tale around her?
I think that's a really interesting point, actually. But I kind of feel that that's probably what we all do. Obviously, when you write a novel, that becomes more explicit for the characters. For many people, it's a kind of way of making sense of the world around us.
Are you a keen reader of fairy tales yourself?
Yeah, most definitely. I was brought up with them. I had a very old, dusty Victorian book of Grimm's fairy tales. They were pretty grim, actually. They are funny, but they're very deep and dark. There's murder and there's betrayal and there's loss and you know, all sorts of things in fairy tales. So I think they make quite an impression on me very early on. What you come across, what you read, and when you're a child, I think stays with me, and that's certainly the case with fairy tales, definitely.
The fairy tales are the very often deal with that threat to childish innocence. Actually, you bring out in The Girl in the Red Coat. I mean, she's somewhat reminiscent of Little Red Riding Hood. The grandfather figure is the ultimate predator. He's a wolf in many ways, isn't he?
He is a wolf, he is. Fairy tales really often dwell in that threshold moment, and that's certainly the case for The Doll Funeral. I mean, in a way, the novel's all about thresholds, which the threshold to the forest and the threshold to adulthood and the threshold of, you know, life and death even. I kept coming back to that when I was writing, and I think that threshold's a place where fairy tales sort of work really well, and I kind of, you know, teach people, I suppose, of the terrors and pitfalls and joys of this world.
Both books are about mother-daughter relationships and daughters who are on the threshold of womanhood.
I'm really interested in parenthood and portraying it in a way that I feel is realistic. I didn't want a kind of chocolate box version of the mother-daughter relationship because I think it can be very fraught at times. I think a theme in both books is how it can kind of both make and unmake you. It's certainly not straightforward. But yeah, I think the mother-daughter relationship is a really potent one, and it's not often explored in fiction. I wrote an article for The Independent asking me to choose the top 10 mother-daughter relationships in fiction. And when you start thinking, I probably missed some important ones out, having said that, but when you start thinking, it's actually quite hard to come up with them, the ones that really concentrate on that relationship in the book. But also, I think just family in general is something that I'm really interested in, and how that kind of motivates and powers us along.
I poked my face out of the car window. A breeze shimmied at the tears on my cheeks, so they changed direction and carved curves across my face. Mick was behind, shoving the case into the boot. I could hear him grunting and swearing. The case was too big, and it was making them angry. "Ruby, now!" She took a tissue from her pocket and pressed it to her mouth. "I'm really going to miss you, you know. But for now, isn't it for the best?" I closed my eyes. "No. You'll be able to forget about it all. Everything that's happened, Ruby." She leaned into the front hedge to whisper, so her torso looked like it was growing out of green. "I wish I could say the same. You'll forget once you're in a different place."
This week's programme is concentrating on psychological thrillers, and I think what you do in your two books is not only take us to the place of our worst fears, as parents being separated from our children and as children being separated from our parents. But you actually take it that step further, which I think a great psychological novel always does, where you challenge the perceptions of both the reader and the characters as to what those relationships were in the first place. And I think you do that very successfully.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so glad that came across, actually, because it's something I really, really wanted to examine. And both of them, to a certain extent, are about forming your own identity. And how do you hang on to that identity, actually, both in the family and in the wider world? And I think in The Doll Funeral, I probably take that a step further in that, you know, it's about, are you shaped by the past, or can you actually, through, if you go through trials of fire and ice and, you know, with great will, can you actually change what the past has set out for you and change your future and actually choose your future? So that's something I'm really interested in exploring.
Well, I'm certainly very much looking forward to reading more than the first couple of chapters.
Well, thank you very much, and I do hope you enjoy the rest of it.
Kate Hamer, thank you very much for sharing your fantastic authorship with us.
Thank you very much. It's been lovely to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. My thanks to Kate Hamer. Both The Girl in the Red Coat and The Doll Funeral are available commercially.
This is Read On Air.
Adam and Eve and Pinch Me went down to the river to bathe. Adam and Eve were drowned. Who do you think was saved? This nasty playground riddle is a favourite of Jerry Leach, a charming con man who has sponged off five women. With a twist of irony, as callous as he is himself, he is about to fall victim to one of the women he's preyed upon. Ruth Rendell, who died in 2015, was best known as the creator of Inspector Wexford. But, as Barbara Vine, she was also the author of a string of outstanding psychological thrillers. Astor's book, The House of Stairs and A Fatal Inversion, established her as a master of the genre. However, in 2002, she published Adam and Eve and Pinch Me under her own name, and for me, it's the pick of the bunch. From page one, she creates an uneasy world of swirling, half-seen events, in which neither the characters nor the reader can be sure of the evidence of their senses. The story starts in West London with Minty, a 30-something foundling who suffers from obsessive compulsive disorder and is haunted by the ghost of her former lover.
Minty knew it was a ghost sitting in the chair because she was frightened. If it were only something she'd imagined, she wouldn't have been afraid. You couldn't be when it was something that came out of your own mind. It was early evening, but being winter time, quite dark. She'd just come home from work, let herself in the front door and put the hall light on. The front room door was open, and the ghost was sitting on an upright chair in the middle of the room with its back to her. She'd put the chair there to stand on and change a light bulb before she went out in the morning and forgotten to put it back. Her mouth tightly covered up with both hands to keep the scream in, she took one step nearer. She thought, what will I do if it turns round? Ghosts in stories are grey like the people on black and white television, or else see-through. But this one had short, dark brown hair and a brown neck and a black leather jacket. Minty didn't have to see its face to know it was her late fiancé, Jock. Suppose it stayed there so that she couldn't use the room. It wasn't absolutely still. The head moved a bit, and then the right leg. Both feet edged back as if it were going to get up. Minty squeezed her eyes tight shut. Everything was silent. A shriek out in the street from one of the kids that lived opposite made her jump, and she opened her eyes. The ghost was gone.
The man she knew as Jock Lewis is, in fact, Jerry Leach. Having deserted his wife and conned Minty out of her meagre life savings by promising to marry her, he then faked his own death in the Ladbroke Grove rail crash. As Minty battles poverty and her demons, obsessively bathing and scrubbing herself clean, Jerry is already seducing his next meal ticket, a high-flying career woman who is only too happy to be rescued from single life by the man she knows as Jeff Lee. Meanwhile, Jerry's wife Zilla is herself in need of rescue. She too received the official-looking letter informing her of Jerry's death, but unlike Minty, she knows it's a fake. Abandoned and broke, she's struggling to raise their two children and only coping because her local Tory MP is supporting her. A rising star and strong advocate of traditional family values, this MP is keen to keep the fact that he's gay out of the news. When he suggests that they get married, Zilla is forced to choose between security and living a lie.
Zilla stripped off the children's clothes and put jeans, t-shirts, sweaters and Jordan's anorak to soak in cold water in the sink. She switched on the fan heater and put a match to the fire she'd laid earlier. It was strange how Jim's never seemed to notice the state of the place or the inadequacy of the fittings or, come to that, the cold. At any rate, he never mentioned them. Did this augur well for a life companion or not? Of course he was a pal of Sir Ronald. If she married him, she and Jim's would no doubt occasionally have Sir Ronald to dine, perhaps in the members' dining room. As she began making scrambled eggs for the children's tea, Zilla decided that if she did marry Jim's, no way was she going to do the cooking in future, or any housework as long as she lived. Who was it said, "I'll never be cold or hungry again"?
Needless to say, the three strands of Jerry Leach's parasitic life cannot be kept separate forever, and as the plot twists and turns, so they intertwine to ensnare him. While much of the book's suspense comes from wondering exactly how Jerry is going to get his comeuppance, the psychological thrill that makes this such a good read comes from Ruth Rendell's ability to show all her characters in equally good and bad light. Like the London street Minty lives in, Jerry is as gentrified as he is squalid. Minty herself is both infuriating and deserving of our sympathy. As such, Ruth Rendell plays a subtle tug of war with the reader's loyalties. In one chapter, we find ourselves agreeing with Minty's neighbours, the cheerful policeman and his wife, that Minty is better off believing herself bereaved than knowing she's been deceived. But we soon discover that they and we were wrong. Even the unfolding political farce of the gay MP trying to hide behind a bigamous marriage proves to be more than just comic relief. Adam and Eve and Pinch Me presents a world in which people are forced to invent stories to stop their lives from falling apart. It's a world without moral certainty that, in the book's more surreal sections, questions our ability to pass judgment at all.
Zilla thought the chances of another wee one slender in the extreme. She had no experience of interviews or journalists, but was already frightened of them. Still, she had long ago cultivated the art of banishing unpleasant thoughts from her mind. It was the only form of defence she knew. So every time a picture of Jim's as Shadow Minister of State at the Home Office or Under Secretary for Health came into her head, and she had a vision of a reporter appearing on her doorstep, she thrust it away. And whenever a voice whispered in her mind's ear, "Tell me something about your previous marriage, Mrs. Malcolm Smith," she plugged it up. After all, she knew Jerry wouldn't reappear. What surer way could there be of making plain your intention to disappear than by announcing your death?
Why I love this book and want to share it as a hidden gem is because it blends the accessibility of Ruth Rendell's Inspector Wexford crime novels with the moral and emotional complexities of Barbara Vine's psychological thrillers. As such, it reads like true crime. As in life, none of the characters in this complex case is altogether bad or altogether blameless. Theirs is a tale of unforeseen consequences with multiple victims. By taking what is essentially a cozy village crime story and setting it amid the impersonal streets of a grimy city, Rendell isolates her characters from any sense of community. This makes them more vulnerable, more human, and the story more tragic. As such, I find it chilling and thrilling and a page-turner from start to finish. But why did Ruth Rendell choose to write under two different names? And why, as a psychological thriller, was Adam and Eve and Pinch Me not a Barbara Vine book? It's a question I'd never really got to the bottom of until Robert Kirkwood played me an interview he'd recorded with her back in 2013.
One of the most prolific authors in the RNIB Talking Books Library, under her own name or under her pseudonym Barbara Vine, is Lady Rendell, who joins me now. Now, I believe I have to call you Ruth.
Yes, please.
Now, what's the difference between a Barbara Vine novel and a Ruth Rendell novel?
Well, the Barbara Vines are, more serious and slower, and they're usually told in the first person, almost invariably, and they have a quite different tone, I think, to them. I always say that I leave that to my readers to decide the difference, but I am very clear in my mind that it is different, though I don't deliberately, purposely, write in a different style. It's just that I know before I begin that it's going to be a Vine or a Rendell. And in that way, it turns out that they fulfil the Rendell or Vine requirements.
So you never start one as Rendell and think, no, this is a Vine?
No, I never have. It's strange, isn't it? I don't know why, but it's never happened.
It's strange the way you describe Barbara Vine as well. Do you think Barbara Vine is another person?
No, it's me.
It's you. But Stephen King has explored writing under pseudonyms, and when you sit down to write, he becomes not someone else, but a variation of himself, someone with a slightly different character. But it is just Ruth Rendell writing under a different name.
I know what Stephen means. And I don't know whether I'm like that. Perhaps I am to a certain extent. But I do know that when I write as Barbara Vine, it is somehow very different. Not perhaps the style, but it is the way I write about it. It is different. But whether I am a different person, I doubt.
My thanks to Robert for clearing up that mystery. All Ruth Rendell's books, both in her own name and as Barbara Vine, are available in various forms from the RNIB Library, where you'll find Adam and Eve and Pinch Me, superbly read by Francis Barber, as TB15380. Clearly, creating an atmosphere of dread is the key to writing a good psychological thriller. And as Robert Kirkwood discovered when he talked to Val McDermott, it was fear of what could happen that led her to write The Vanishing Point.
Can I sit beside the window again? Jimmy tugged at her elbow. Can I, Steph? As long as you promise not to open it in mid-flight. He gave her a suspicious look, then grinned. Would I get sucked out into space if I did? Yup, you'd be the boy in the moon. She waved him onward. They'd picked up speed and were almost at the point where they'd have to load their bags and the contents of their pockets into a plastic tray to pass through the X-ray scanner. Stephanie caught sight of a large perspex enclosure beyond the metal detector and pursed her lips. "Remember what I told you, Jimmy," she said firmly. "You know I'll set off the alarms, and then I'll have to stay inside that clear box until somebody checks me over. You're not allowed in with me." He pouted. Why not? It's the rules.
And now joining me on the line is Val McDermott. Tell us a little bit about Vanishing Point.
Well, I like to write standalone novels in between my series novels, partly because it gives me sort of a refreshment from the main characters, but also partly because it allows me to tell stories that don't work within the confines of the series novel.
Mm.
And the idea for Vanishing Point started off when I was travelling in America with my son. Now, I've got knee replacements, so I set off the metal detectors. And in some of the airports in America, they put you in this kind of perspex box, a perspex enclosure, while they wait for somebody to come available to actually pat you down and wand you. Now, you go into the box, but you're not allowed to take your child with you. So I was with my boy, and he was about 6 or 7. And because I've got the nasty, devious mind that I have, I'm standing in the box waiting to be patted down, looking across at my boy who's just standing there by the luggage belt. And I think to myself, what would happen if somebody came up right now and just took his hand and walked away?
Mm.
And that really is the starting point for the book. A child is abducted in a busy American airport. And, of course, having got that far, having got that initial idea, and then I had to spend a lot of time thinking about who this child is and why they've been kidnapped and why they've been kidnapped there and all the sort of things that flow from that. So from that initial starting point, I had to do a lot of thinking and planning and what if and storytelling to myself.
Now, I've got a child that age, and the thought of that absolutely terrifies mm-hmm. me.
Yeah, well, it completely terrified me at the time. You know, I was standing there thinking, if somebody took my kid, then there's nothing I could do. because although an airport's a very secure place, the security's all unidirectional. They're focused on the potential terrorist, the person who might want to bring a plane down, the person who might want to cause an explosion. So the person who set the metal detector off is the suspicious one. As soon as the person has set the metal detector off, does anything that in their eyes is more suspicious, nobody's paying attention to anything else. And it's petrifying. Anybody who has ever looked after a child for more than 5 minutes knows that terrible moment of, where's the kid? And so that's the kind of buzz of anxiety that's going on all through the book. The child is missing. The child has been abducted. And then we have to go into the backstory of who this woman is and who the child is. And that takes us into the world of celebrity, the kind of instant fame of reality television world. Well, I invented a whole new reality television show on an island, a fictitious island in the Firth of Forth. So it's nice to think outside the box sometimes.
You were talking about the devious mind and about that terrifying you. Have you ever written something that is you've thought, no, that's going too far?
I've often been in the process of writing when I've thought, this is the next bit I'm going to do, then thought, no, actually, you don't need to do that. That's too much. I think I'm quite strict with myself about not tipping over into the sort of gleeful, gratuitous violence just for the sake of it. I take my time and I think very carefully about what I'm writing, and very much that have I done enough to make the reader's head do the rest of the work is kind of where I'm coming from. I remember, I have a clinical psychologist that I talk to, particularly about the Tony Hill and Carol Jordan books, and I remember talking to him about one killer, and I described what this killer was going to do, and he said, yeah, that's all very plausible, that's psychologically plausible. He said, but he would also, and then he listed a couple of other things that someone with that particular paradigm would do, and I just went, you know, I don't need to put that. That is too much. I don't need to have that in my head, never mind in my book. So there's you know, real life is in many instances far worse, far more terrifying than anything that we crime writers can come up with. But you have to be, I think, very strict with yourself in your head about where that line is.
She looked back at Jimmy. One of the TSA agents appeared to be talking to him, a tall man in black uniform trousers and blue shirt. But something was off kilter. Stephanie frowned. He was wearing a cap. That was what it was. None of the other TSA people wore anything on their heads. As she watched, the man reached for Jimmy's hand.
My thanks again to Robert and to Val. The Vanishing Point is available as TB20383, and you'll find a range of Val McDermott's other books in the RNIB library.
This is Read On Air.
Now, as promised, back to Sam Hepburn, who shares the books of her life, one of which, by remarkable serendipity, was written by another author who's featured on today's show. So, Sam Hepburn, we have a feature called Books of Your Life, typically one read as a child, one that's a rainy day book, and a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, I've picked any of the Just William books, William Brown. And when you say resonate, I mean, I'm still listening to them. You know, I was listening to them with my children in the car. I still listen to them with my husband in the car. They're what lulled me to sleep. Well, I read them to myself, and then my children all were lulled after we'd read whatever we were going to read to them. You know, they would put Just William on, and we can all do it, the Martin Jarvis, off by heart. And it's still funny. It's so clever and funny and witty. It's brilliant writing. It has warmth and heart. And I mean, I love Mr. Brown, you know. He's just very sorry for him.
It's funny how one's sympathies move from William to the parents as we get older, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think even when I was younger, I could see this poor man was living a nightmare.
And a rainy day book, a book you would love to curl up with, given a day of no chores and no writing.
Well, one of my favourite books is The Rose of Tibet by Lionel Davidson. Do you know it?
I know Lionel Davidson from other books like Comiskey Heights.
It's just about a sort of loose, sort of young man who ends up in a monastery in Tibet. He's looking for his brother. And just the descriptions of his journey and the problems that he faces and what people eat and what's going on in the monastery. It is a wonderful, wonderful read.
And a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
I've just finished His Bloody Project, Graham McRae Burnett. Again, it's about, I suppose I respond to books that describe a world that I don't know. And this is describing a world of sort of 19th century crofter poverty and oppression by the laird and how you just function in that world. And again, there's a sort of a sharpness, there's an edge of almost humour. It's so sort of not humour, but it's perception of the world, I think. It's somebody looking out at the world with a particular eye.
On one occasion, when I was 5 or 6 years old, I was flying a kite my father had made me from some scraps of sackcloth. The kite plunged into some crops, and I ran, quite unthinking, to retrieve it. I was on my knees trying to disentangle the string from among the corn when I felt myself gripped on the shoulder by a great hand and roughly hauled to track. I was still clutching my kite, and Lachlan Broad tore it from me and dashed it to the ground. He then hit me on the side of the head with the flat of his hand, knocking me down. I was so frightened that I lost control of my bladder, causing our neighbour a great deal of mirth. I was then picked up and dragged the length of the village, where Broad berated my father for the damage I had done to his crops. The commotion brought my mother to the door, and at this point Broad released me from his grip, and I scuttled into the house like a scared dog and cowered in the byre. Later that evening, Lachlan Broad returned to our house and demanded 5 shillings in compensation for the portion of his crops I had destroyed. I hid in the back chamber with my ear to the door. My mother refused, arguing that if any damage had been done to his crops, it had been caused by him dragging me through his rig. Broad then took his complaint to the constable, who dismissed it. One morning, some days later, my father found that a great portion of our crops had been trampled underfoot overnight. It was not known who carried out this destruction, but no one doubted that it was Lachlan Broad and his kinsmen.
It's a terrific book. It takes you to places you could never imagine going to, doesn't
absolutely, it? Absolutely. And there's a huge amount of darkness there. I mean, what happens to his sister and things, which are just kind of almost accepted.
Well, thank you so much, Sam, for joining us in the studio today, and very, very much look forward to your next book.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
All of her selections are available in various formats from the RNIB Library. So that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Kate and Sam and to all our interviewees. And thanks to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, what you're reading, and ideas for books that I should read up on. Next week, we'll have our tongues firmly in our cheeks as we explore the world of satire. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.